Most of us are great at listening to music. Some of us can play. Some of us can write music. A few of us can do all of those things well. We start with an assumption that Joby Talbot can do pretty much anything with music. He's a British-born composer now living in Ashland. He's composed music for concerts, for ballets, for the screen, and more. His work is easily found online, and it will be heard throughout the coming animated film Sing. Joby Talbot in the studio with us. Thanks for joining us today.
Hi, Jeff. Great to be here.
Good to have you here. You describe yourself as a composer of music for concert, stage, and screen. Was composing something you wanted to do from a really early age?
I think so, yeah. I was 9 years old when I first performed a piece of mine in public, and it wasn't long after that that I decided this is what I wanted to do with my life. I don't know, I just, I don't know, it's that my way of expressing myself to the world, and yeah, I'm just lucky that people want to pay me to do it, because I'd be doing it anyway if they didn't.
Really, you do this for free? Oh, you like love it that much?
Yeah, no, tell anyone.
Don't tell anyone. Okay, right. Okay, let's leave that one a secret. Talk about your training. You apparently worked with two masters, and I wonder about the kinds of things that you get from someone who's done this for a long time versus what clearly is an innate talent if you were already writing your own compositions by age nine. And that was probably not the first one either.
Well, I don't know. What do you get? I mean, some people say you can't teach composition any more than you can teach, you know, writing. But actually, I think there's a lot you can learn from. I mean, I was lucky. I had some amazing teachers. It's not, they don't teach you the kind of the DNA of what you want to say, but they facilitate you finding a way into actually getting into a form that anyone might actually understand or want to listen to.
Can you remember moments in the training when there were ahas, like, ah, that's how to do this thing I've been trying to do for a long time?
Oh, yeah, definitely. I remember getting a lesson. I remember my first composition lesson with the wonderful composer Brian Elias, who I was lucky enough to study with in London. And he said, he looked at the score and he was like, yes, oh, there are lots of good things in here. And then he rather firmly closed it and put it aside. And it was quite clear that we were never going to look at that again. And then we had a whole lesson all about the nursery rhyme, Jack and Jill Went Up the Hill. Because it's dun da dun da dun da dun da 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 da. And then there's like call and response. And, you know, he's just setting up the like phrase patterns. And I was sitting there like kind of my tiny mind blowing quietly in the corner.
Did Brian Elias ever open that score that he thought?
No. Neither did I ever again.
Really?
We moved on.
So over the course of a career like yours, where you've been composing for a very long time and a lot of stuff, it appears, I mean, quite a prolific composer. I mean, is there still a bunch of stuff that is sitting on shelves that has never seen the light of day or things that started and you went, not good enough, I won't finish this?
Well, I mean, I'm a real sort of perfectionist. So if I'm going to do something, I'm going to do it until it's finished and it's absolutely right. I mean, some people sometimes ask the question, how do you know when a piece is finished? I'm like, well, when it's 100% perfect, obviously. So I don't tend to have lots of stuff sitting around. I know a lot of composers do. I mean, you know, sometimes you get a call and you say, oh, there's a little job here. You know, have you got anything, you know, rattling around? You might, no, everything I've ever written is sort of out there. And I don't think I'm that prolific. I find it very hard writing music, which I think is a good thing. Because, you know, it means that, you know, you're really, everything you put down has got a real point. Because it's not just something that I just kind of like, you know, knock off of an afternoon and then go to the pub. I find it really difficult. So
so there's not a drawer, for example, for ballet stuff. It's like, oh, well, you have a ballet? Well, here's a piece that could work for that. I mean, you really write it specifically for the circumstances.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And the ballets I've been doing recently have been narrative ballets. So, you know, it's really bespoke storytelling through music. It's a really hard thing to do. I mean, the last one I did for the Royal Ballet in London was, which I actually wrote mostly in Ashland, was A Winter's Tale. I mean, and anybody out there who knows that play, I mean, it's a hard enough play to understand when you're actually reading the words off the page or hearing an actor tell them to you. To understand it when it's an orchestra telling it to you, I mean, it's well-nigh impossible. I'm not sure how I did it.
Well, given all the kinds of work you do, I mean, concert, stage, screen, voice, orchestra, even rock band, I mean, are you unusually omnivorous for a composer?
Yeah, that's a good word for it, yeah. Yeah, well, I mean, I never really understood. I mean, it's kind of different in America, I think, and it's maybe different now than when I was growing up. But when I was a kid, you know, you met people who were classical music people or pop music people. And I used to think, why? I mean, there's all this good music, there's good music and bad music, and it doesn't matter what genre it falls into. So I've been lucky enough to, you know, I spent 8 years playing in a rock band. I mean, I was kind of the guy in charge of the kind of orchestral bits. Mm-hmm. But, you know, doing, you know, and doing film music, I mean, you get asked to do you know, just all kinds of things. I mean, on Sing, there's, you know, there's a whole storyline where it's all this kind of like pumping kind of guitar driven sort of rock score. And I'm like, well, I've never done that before, but hey, I'll give it a go, and it worked out.
What, does it seem like people should stop asking that question? I mean, it seems like the likes of Duke Ellington and George Gershwin should have proven a long time ago that there's lots of room for crossover.
Yeah, well, interestingly, they're both American. I think in England, there's still a slightly snobby kind. I think there's a sense in the classical world particularly that if you have sort of sullied your hands by, you know, dipping into the world of, you know, media music or pop music, that somehow you're kind of no longer to be taken seriously. I mean, it constantly strikes me spending time in America. There's this whole can-do thing here, and there's the can't-do thing in Europe, and which has its own, you know, validity. But you know, people in Europe are always looking for sort of excuses not to take something seriously. You know, you look down the listings magazines in London. There's so much to see; you could never see even a fraction of it. So you find yourself sort of ticking stuff. Oh no, that's a good reason not to see that. That's a good reason not to see that. So you know, it's like, oh, that composer. Shall I? Oh no, they did that. So let's not worry about it.
A long culling process before you make your decision.
Yeah, so you end up just staying and watching TV.
Joe B. Talbot is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, a composer born and trained in England and living in the Ashland area now. You can join us if you'd like at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. I want to give people a chance to hear some of your work. We have queued up the beginning of Path of Miracles, which tells a famous story. Can you set this up a bit for us?
At the very beginning of it, you might want to cue at the beginning of different movements, because the first 5 minutes sounds like a car slowly starting. This was a piece I wrote 10 years ago. Actually, it's the 10th anniversary of it in 2017, for a wonderful, amazing choir called Tenebrae in England, who wanted a piece that was about the Camino de Santiago de Compostela in Galicia in northern Spain, which is this 900-year-old pilgrimage. People have been making this journey to Santiago to visit the relics of supposed relics of the St. James the Great, who was one of the apostles of Christ, whose remains somehow mysteriously washed up in northwestern Spain. Not sure how they got there from Jerusalem, but anyway. And I wrote this piece that's all about kind of pilgrimage, and it's really about the kind of hopes and dreams of 900 years of pilgrimage.
Let's get a taste of Path of Miracles. So, Joby Talbot, did you pretty much give each piece a point along the pilgrimage?
Yeah, there's four movements, and each piece is named after a destination on the pilgrimage route, starting off at the mountain pass where pilgrims would cross over the Pyrenees from France, southern France, down into Spain, then moving across northern Spain and ending up in Santiago. That bit we're listening to now is León. It's the third movement of the four. And I visited there with my family back when I was researching the piece, and had this extraordinary experience standing in the cathedral. The cathedral's got the second most acreage of stained glass of any building in the world. It used to be the third on the list, but then the second on the list fell down from lack of wall. And the sun was setting, and the red sunset was shining through these amazing medieval stained glass into this extraordinary Gothic interior. And this was the kind of music I was hearing in my head.
Wow. And I meant to ask about that, too. I mean, whether music is constantly present in your head, if it's the kind of thing where you have to write snippets down every so often to register the things that have arisen in your brain?
Yeah, I tend to do an awful lot of, you know, mumbling into my iPhone when walking down the street if I suddenly have an idea. I mean, usually it's very specific. I mean, I have kind of just sort of ideas floating around, but when I have a commission to do something, I'll be thinking about it really quite intently. And it's funny. It's like that. I was thinking about this the other day. The big flower theme in my Alice in Wonderland ballet, which is this rather carefree waltz. I mean, you know, it couldn't sound less kind of worried about it. I remember writing it. I was lying on a daybed in my studio with gritted teeth and clenched fist. Think of an idea. You'd never guess.
So from this angst-ridden process comes this lighter-than-air sort of thing?
Yeah, quite a lot of smashing my head against the wall, sometimes literally. We get there in the end.
I'm just impressed by it. That's an hour-long a cappella piece. I mean, yeah. this is what Tenebrae wanted, right?
This is what they originally were going to get four composers to write, you know, one composer to write each movement. And then I was like, really? Sure, you don't want me to just do the whole thing myself? So I did it, and it really was. It was one of the most amazing experiences I've had. You can hear such amazing singers. There's another choir, an American choir, Conspirare from Texas, who recently released a recording of it too. And they're both wonderful. I mean, I can't even tell you what it's like to write something like that. You know, you write it, for yourself and for the people you love, and then to have it disseminated, you know, right around the world by all these different people performing it. You know, it's an extraordinary thing.
Quite humbling, it sounds like.
Yeah, I mean, music is a communicative art form, and it's a very generous, and I think, unegotistical art form. I mean, you're just throwing it out there and giving it to people who are going to perform it, and then they're giving it to the people who are going to listen to it, and you just sit back and watch and kind of wonder. And also, when you finish a piece and you hand it off, it's like it has a life of its own. I mean, I actually do remember writing that opening thing we just heard, but often I have no idea where it came from at all. Did I write that? Wow.
Well, it sounds like you can be impressed by your own work still then, too.
Yeah, I know. Maybe that sounds terribly egotistical, but it's not meant to.
All right. Let's talk pieces for full orchestra. We have a hovercraft queued up. What can you tell us about that?
Oh, that was a piece. I wrote it, actually, as a standalone sort of concert opener for an orchestra in London called the Kensington Symphony Orchestra. And then it got used by the wonderful choreographer Wayne McGregor for a piece he did with the Royal Ballet, which opened up a whole other chapter of my life writing music for ballet.
So let's hear some of Hovercraft. I'm always fascinated with the need for a composer to be familiar with instruments. I mean, how many do you play yourself?
Well, like oboe was my main instrument growing up. Quite a good instrument for a composer to play, I think, because you're playing a lot, but you're not playing all the time like a violinist. So you actually have a time to sort of look around and see what everybody else is doing, trying to learn. And you're not doing the crossword and bored sick like a percussionist or a brass player might be for a lot of the time. So I play the oboe, and I can play the flute and clarinet a little bit, and I play piano, some kind of percussion and stuff. Bass guitar badly, but so I don't play any stringed instruments. I don't play any brass instruments. But you just got to learn how these instruments work. You've got to talk to players, you know, try stuff out, make mistakes, get corrected, and just gradually learn.
Have there been episodes when you the violinist, you presented a score and they said, you know, that's really going to be hard to handle those notes together?
Oh yes, but I'm just working now on a guitar concerto. I mean, and that's like ridiculously hard. I mean, the guitar, the most popular instrument in the world, people just pick it up and play. My son plays. And yet, if you don't play, it's just complete alchemy. It's like, how on earth does that noise come out of that instrument? So that's tricky.
Joby Talbot, tell us about the Sing project, this film coming from Illumination Entertainment.
Ah, Sing, yes. It comes out Christmas, later this month, and it's just a thing of complete loveliness. It's a big, family-friendly, completely kind of feel-good. It's kind of what the world needs right now. Mm-hmm. It's a movie. It's all about music. It's about a singing competition. Singing animals. Matthew McConaughey plays this kind of over-enthusiastic koala who runs a theatre. He's just mad for the theatre. But it's not going so well. He's not a great business mind, let's just put it this way. And he decides to save his theatre by having a singing competition. Not the greatest idea in the world. No one's very impressed with this idea. But a whole series of kind of accidents and fate intervening, it ends up being a wonderful thing. And it's got this ridiculous all-star cast of Seth MacFarlane and Reese Witherspoon and Scarlett Johansson. And I was lucky enough to be asked to write the score.
Now, a bunch of great songs, but you're working around those songs, right? You're doing everything in between?
Yeah, there's actually, it must be a record, there's actually 103 songs. In the film, but obviously you only hear like tiny little snippets. I mean, there's a big sequence near the beginning, for example, where there's they have all the animals in auditioning, and you hear, sometimes you just hear like a couple of notes of a song. So they get through them quite quickly. And then my job is to help the storytelling of the film, and in particular the character development of the characters, because I think what this film has kind of over and above most other animated films I've ever seen is a real kind of heart and soul. You really fall for the characters and kind of want the best for them. It relies very much on that. And so sometimes, you know, it really requires score to kind of help you inside the characters' heads, help you kind of identify with what they want and how they're feeling and their backstories. I mean, for example, there's one character, the Mina the Elephant, who's played by the wonderful young singer Tori Kelly, she's just painfully shy and suffers from panic attacks. So every time she opens her mouth to sing, you know, like everything closes in on her, and we only hear her sing at the very end. So all her music is internalized, and it's up to me to kind of show you what that is.
You're providing the characterization musically.
Yeah.
Oh, wow. That's great. So there's been a premiere already, I understand.
Yeah,
right?
The premiere was on Saturday.
Get to meet a few people?
I got to meet Stevie Wonder, who's like, you know, one of my idols. I mean, I think, you know, as my friend Alan Myerson, who is the music engineer on the project, said, you know, there's Stevie Wonder and then there's everyone else. You know, I mean, he's like the modern day Mozart. I mean, a child prodigy. You know, the word genius is bandied around a lot in these days, but he really, I think he's one of the few real live geniuses, you know, on the planet. And he was absolutely charming. He was really, I met him, my 14-year-old son Morris, I also got to meet him, and that was something. I was just kind of, you know, trying to keep it together.
Wow, that's wonderful, and it's just an amazing amount of work that you've done. In fact, I want to run out. We can take people out with a clip from it's a cycle called "Once Around the Sun." I think this is the December piece I picked, and so we can leave with this and instead of our usual end of hour music. And I just want to say thanks to Joby Talbot for joining us today.
It's an absolute pleasure. I'm a huge fan of JP. I listen to it all the time, and it's just great to finally see it in real life.
We're newfound fans of yours. Sing comes out the 21st of December, is that right?
That's right.
Great. Joby Talbot, thanks again so much. And here is December.